It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For the last 21 months, journalist Joshua Johnson has led conversations about issues that affect our country and our communities on 1A, produced by WAMU in Washington and distributed by NPR. Here in Pittsburgh, you hear him from 10 a.m. to noon. And later this week, he'll be bringing you those conversations from the WESA studios. Joshua, welcome to the confluence.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Joshua, when you began 1A in January of 2017, did you have a full grasp at that time, a new administration, a time of even division and maybe even some tumult?
Yeah. I mean, we knew that was what we would be walking into, regardless of who won the election, really. I mean, there's never a bad time to increase the amount of civic dialogue in this country, or civil dialogue in this country, for sure. But we knew that the 2016 election was going to leave people with a lot to talk about, because either we would have the first year of this political upstart, Donald Trump being the president of the United States, or we would have America's first female head of state, who also came with a great deal of her own political history and baggage and so forth. So we knew that no matter who won, the volume of the national conversation was going to be turned up to 11, and people were going to need a place to come talk, vent, sense make, and so on. So we had that much down. How exactly we were going to deal with it was an open question. That's what we had to figure out. But we knew what we were getting into.
How do you explore those newsworthy topics with your guest, but do it in a, shall we say, a creative way to make sure that your listeners are engaged?
Well, we try to make our show as listener-centric as possible, if I can use that word. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that we do that is by soliciting people's personal experiences and their stories that relate to the topics that we're talking about. It's easy to argue somebody's opinion or their perspective or, you know, their reasoned argument for something. But you can't argue the truth of someone's life. You are the expert on your life. And we have found, and I've also found in some of my work prior to 1A, that if you engage people on who they are and on what they've experienced and what makes them them, it changes the whole tone of the discussion. It prevents it from just being people beating each other over the head with their thoughts, beliefs, arguments, opinions. It kind of forces us into a different frame of mind where I hear your story, inevitably in there I find something that I identify with or empathize with or that I am shocked by or that I learn from. And that helps to keep all these policy discussions grounded in the fact that we're talking about real people's lives. This is not theoretical. And there are people in the audience like you, like me, or different from you and me, for whom these issues are incredibly important. That changes the tone from the beginning. And it makes the rest of the debate a lot easier to have.
So you engage them, but is it your job to, in a sense, connect them at a time when it seems almost daily that there is something, someone trying to divide this country?
I don't know if it's my job to connect people. I mean, I can help with a particular kind of connection. Part of the challenge of the era of social media is that people don't need us to connect to one another. They don't literally need NPR or WESA or public media at all to connect. They can just do it themselves on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, social media, YouTube, and so on. What we provide is a special kind of connection. You know, you can connect to one another about the new Bob Woodward book. We can connect you to Bob Woodward. That's the difference. And so what we're trying to offer is a connection that always puts us as just everyday people at the core and then uses the resources we have to bring thought leaders, newsmakers, big names into our discussion space. And somewhere in the middle of that, we build something unique.
You mentioned social media. 1A is pioneering a few new techniques, your own app for voicemails, for example, emails, Facebook comments, Twitter. As the messaging evolves, do you have a favorite way to hear from your listeners?
Not really. They all have their benefits. I mean, they vary. We also use text messages. We have a 1A text club, and sometimes the immediacy and kind of the direct connection of a text message has a benefit. You know, when you text someone and they respond, they only respond to you. So you may get a different kind of a response when you know that the whole world isn't seeing it, but just the folks that are here at 1A will see it. I don't know that I have a favorite. I think the key is just to be as ubiquitous as possible and to kind of, in the words of Wayne Gretzky, skate where the puck is going so that we know that we're ahead of the conversation. We're not kind of chasing after the dialogue like, wait, guys, come back. We're doing a show on that tomorrow. We would rather be proactive about it and say, we're going to do a show on this. Tell us what you think before we finish writing the script. And often what will happen is we'll start getting comments from people and a few of them will coalesce around certain topics and we'll know, oh, this is something we should discuss because a bunch of people are calling this out. Or this is a misconception that we may need to debunk because a bunch of people have been commenting about this and it's incorrect. So maybe we should make sure to bring this up. It helps you listening kind of co-author the show with us. And it just makes for a better program.
Co-author. I was going to ask you, how do you view your role? Interviewer, host, conduit, convener?
I would rather just be, you know,
Joshua Johnson
conversationally. Well, yes, I hope so. I try to just be a good listener. You know, I don't want it to feel like an interrogation. I don't want it to feel like I am, you know, the inside journalist asking hard hitting questions. There are plenty of those. I try to make everyone feel like they're in a welcoming space, like they are free to speak their mind, like I have very worthwhile questions to ask, but I'm not in this to needle you. I mean, it became clear to me early on that I didn't want to start geeking out over celebrities and famous people because eventually I would start treating so-called everyday people with less interest and less respect. And so I have had to figure out, I'm not 100% there, but I'm closer than I was. I've had to figure out one standard to treat everybody, absolutely everybody who comes on the program. And I think it's a good thought exercise. Like if you had to articulate for yourself one standard whereby you would treat every single human being that you will ever meet for the rest of your life, what would it be? If you couldn't treat people differently based on who they are, what they know, how they vote, who they pray to, who they love, what their background is, if you couldn't differentiate, if you had to have one standard for everybody, what would it be? And that's what I try to do on the show. Because then it makes my work a lot easier, right? I don't have to turn it up for one guest and turn it down for another. Mm. We can just do the show. And it equalizes people in a way that I think makes the show better.
The program 1A, your conversations, they're meant to celebrate free speech. I have to ask you, is it a challenge at times to celebrate free speech when the power of some of those words can be so divisive?
No, not for me. I mean, free speech is a value that is inherently American, and it's necessary to our country. And just because some people don't use it well doesn't mean that I can't enjoy it. I mean, those of us who do use it well, that makes it more important for us to use it well and to do it in ways that people can hear it and can encounter it and can take part in it. I can't control what other people do. I can have influence on what we do here, but worrying about the worst practitioners, it just sucks energy away from us doing what we're trying to do. And it doesn't help. I'll say this frankly. It's much more productive to be part of a worthwhile dialogue than to lament that so many other people aren't doing it right. It doesn't mean you shouldn't talk about it.
I got to change directions completely on you for this final question.
Okay.
Sometimes we all need to lighten up. You know, when your show gets into pop culture, sports, does that sort of give you a little bit of a respite?
No. And I'll tell you why. Because we don't want people to hear a show that we do about pop culture and pretend that it's not a serious show and say, oh, today's not the day I need to listen. Let me go listen to something else. No, absolutely not. We feel that pop culture, the arts, movies, music, books, science, nature, the environment, technology, sports. All of these things are part of our culture. And one of 1A's missions is to act as what we like to think of as a national mirror. We want to reflect America back to itself so we can see ourselves more clearly and ask if this is a good look, if this is what we want to be. So when we do shows about pop culture, yes, some of them are meant to be fun. But that doesn't mean that we don't put the same amount of rigor, that we don't do the same quality of journalism, that we don't stress over them, that we're not trying to be as creative or as inventive or as thoughtful as we would in a conversation about the latest scandal out of Capitol Hill or the White House. It all matters. It all helps to paint a picture of America that's accurate. If all we were was a show about the troubles of the world, then our mirror on the nation would basically be like showing you an image of a red anthill and saying, well, there's the forest. That anthill's in the forest, but it's not the forest. There's much more to this ecosystem. And there's much more to the ecosystem of things that Americans think are important. I mean, one of our most popular shows was about cover songs. We had a blast doing an hour about cover songs. But within that conversation, we also talked about how some artists who covered other artists have culturally appropriated what they sang. So there's an aspect of that that deals with race and culture that was very worthy within that conversation. And if you just say, let's have a fun, silly conversation about cover songs, okay, there's room for that. But if we have opportunities to say, oh, we can illuminate somebody with this discussion, you better believe we're going to do it. So we always want people, even when we're doing something that's not on the news cycle, to be engaged, to be connected, and to always know that we never approach this show with frivolity. Fun, yes, but there's too much going on right now in the world for us to take any of this airtime like it's not valuable. It's valuable because it's yours. You have helped contribute to keep your station on the air, and so we want to be good stewards of that time. And no matter what we discuss, we want you to come away from the show not only saying, wow, that was time well spent, but moreover saying, I got to tell somebody about this. They need to hear what I just heard.
Joshua Johnson is the host of NPR's 1A. He'll be in Pittsburgh this week for an evening with Joshua Johnson, September 20th at 7 p.m. at the August Wilson Center for African American Culture. Joshua, thanks so much and safe travels.
Thanks, Kevin. Thank you very much.
I'm Megan Harris. Coming up on The Confluence, under the Commonwealth's current election law, only registered Democrats and Republicans can cast ballots in their own party's primary. 90.5 WESA's Katie Meyer joins us from Harrisburg to break down a new proposal that could give moderates a stronger voice. One Democratic representative has identified himself as a survivor of clergy sex abuse. Now he's asking the legislature to eliminate the criminal statute of limitations in child sex abuse cases and create a temporary window for older survivors to sue their perpetrators. And how are co-working spaces carving their niche in the Pittsburgh market? Those conversations and more coming up on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the first formal treaty between the new United States and Native Americans is signed at Fort Pitt in downtown Pittsburgh in 1778. The document allowed American troops to pass through territory held by the Delawares in exchange for goods and weapons. Delaware warriors also agreed to fight with Americans against the British in the American Revolution. Shortly after it was signed, however, the Native tribe and the American soldiers began to disagree, and the treaty was eventually forgotten, with many of the Delaware warriors fighting for the British. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for September 19th, 2018.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania remains one of 11 states to have a closed primary. In other words, you can only vote within your registered political party. A top lawmaker wants to change that, and let's find out how and why. Katie Meyer is WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
So, Katie, what does the Senate President Pro Tem Joe Scarnati want to do?
So Scarnati's proposal, which was just introduced the other week, he wants to open up Pennsylvania's currently closed primary process to unaffiliated voters. So right now in the primary elections, only Democrats can vote for Democrats, Republicans can vote for Republicans. And what this would do is let people who are not affiliated with either party or any party vote in these elections. So it'd be a pretty significant change. There are a lot of people on both sides of the aisle that are for it and against it, But he says it would help get people who are not really strongly on either side of the political spectrum heard in state politics.
So what about third parties, the Green Party, the Libertarian Party? Would they be affected under the current iteration of this proposal?
As the proposal currently exists, no, they still would not be able to participate. You know, there are like petition processes that could get a third party candidate onto a ballot, although that does not happen frequently at all. But no, I mean, it's not to say this bill couldn't change. It hasn't moved. It hasn't really been debated at all yet. But as Scarnati has it written, it would not include third parties.
Realizing that the language of the legislation could change, would it be truly an open primary in the sense that an independent voter maybe vote for a Republican in one race and a Democrat in another? Is that a possibility or is that still to be seen?
That appears to be a possibility under this current language, yes.
I find, Katie, in your reporting, one of the most interesting aspects from your stories that the reason Scarnati gave for his proposal. What was that?
Yeah, so as I said, so he essentially thinks that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party have both moved too far to the fringes or to the sides of, you know, their respective political affiliations. So Republicans going farther right, Democrats moving farther left. And he says from his position as somebody whose job it is to kind of get consensus between the parties and to get legislation over the legislature's threshold into the governor, you know, from his position, it's become harder to do that as people have become more divided.
So what's the argument against such open primaries?
You know, I think a lot of party people who are very strongly affiliated with certain parties say, you know, the primary is our opportunity to pick our own candidate. So allowing people who aren't part of our party to vote there defeats the purpose. Others would argue the opposite. There are a lot of different, I think, beliefs about what purpose a primary election should actually serve.
Final question, Katie. Very late in the legislative session, chances of passage, or is it just a matter of starting the discussion?
Yes, Scarnati has said himself, this is it would be a long shot to pass this session. We only have a handful of session days, voting days even left. Yeah, I talked to Scarnati's chief of staff, Drew Crompton, and he was saying that, you know, maybe if we get a debate on this, we get a committee hearing, we at least get this on the radar so that we can reintroduce it next session and start it fresh there.
Katie Meyer is WESA's Capitol Bureau Chief. Thanks so much, Katie.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In the wake of a Pennsylvania grand jury report detailing mass child sexual abuse within the Catholic Church, state lawmakers are considering changes to the statute of limitation law. Among them, Democratic Representative Mark Rossi of Berks County, who says he's a survivor of clergy abuse. 90.5 WESA's Virginia Alvino Young spoke to Rossi about his proposal to eliminate the criminal statute of limitations in child sexual abuse cases and create a temporary window for older survivors to sue their perpetrators. Please be advised this interview contains a description of sexual assault.
Representative Mark Rossi, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So a 2-year civil window that would allow anyone of any age to file a lawsuit, that could obviously benefit survivors who are seeking justice. But could that amendment also have an impact on general public safety for children today?
Oh, absolutely. The reason victims are coming forward to do this is they want to expose their predator. And by exposing our predator, we're hoping to protect future generations of children in Pennsylvania. You know, some victims, do they deserve compensation for the egregious crimes committed against them? Absolutely. But if we can expose these predators, we can save future generations.
You yourself have proposed similar changes and reforms before, but what makes you believe that this time around will be different?
This report is so expansive. The crimes in it are so heinous, egregious, that if the public isn't outraged now at what they've read in this grand jury report, what will it take? I mean, we had 2 grand juries out of Philadelphia, the Altoona Johnstown grand jury report, Jerry Sandusky. What do we need here in Pennsylvania? We have been the epicenter for child sex abuse. If we can't get this done now, you know, I think some legislators who have been standing in our way, blocking this bill, probably need to find a different type of job.
Well, in the past, you have received quite a bit of support for your proposals from the House, including the Western Pennsylvania delegation.
Yes.
So right now, where do you perceive your biggest roadblocks as coming from?
We expect the House to be supportive overwhelmingly. The problem is when the bill moves out of the House and when it goes to the Senate, what is Majority Leader Jake Corman going to do? What is the Senate President Pro Temp going to do? Senator Joe Scarnati? They have a choice to make.
In the wake of the grand jury report, there are other proposals being floated that are originating from both parties, from both chambers, things like a commission to investigate abuse in institutions, increasing penalties for those who fail to report abuse. Do you see these as being complementary to what you're trying to accomplish or more of a distraction?
Some of them, of the mandated reporting, is definitely complementary. Some of these other reports about setting up a commission or doing a constitutional amendment, that's just to further kick the can down the road. By the time that we even would get to that point, the outrage of the public would already be gone, and legislators would be able to slip away and not have to do what they're supposed to do here and pass this legislation. So they put those amendments up and they put those kind of things forward as distractions. The only path to justice right now is the two-year window. Those victims only had 2 years civilly to come forward. That's just insane. Victims, especially child victims, they don't know what a statute of limitation is. I tell people, when I was in the shower getting raped by Father Graff, I wasn't sitting there thinking, my clock is ticking now. I have statute of limitations. I only have 5 years to report this criminally and 2 years civilly to sue him. Those time limits we had in there in the 70s, 80s, and 90s were so arbitrary. They protected the pedophiles. They protected the institutions.
What do you say to those who say if you were to open up a civil window and make the church potentially subject to a lot of lawsuits that it could bankrupt the church?
Right. But is the church, are they liable for some of these damages? Yes. We are going to put the liability back on the people who caused it. And I don't think that there should be a problem with that. Right now, the taxpayers of Pennsylvania are paying this liability when people are, these victims are damaged and can't go to work through unemployment compensation, or they can't get a health insurance and they're going to hospital because they have mental breakdowns, or they're alcoholics or drug addicts. Who's paying that bill? The taxpayers. So the church has been riding on the back of these taxpayers, letting them take care of the problems. And now, you know, it's judgment day for the church. They have an opportunity to do the morally correct thing here. And if they don't, they're going to have to look themselves in the mirror and wonder why nobody's in their pews.
Representative Mark Rossi, thank you again so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
90.5 WESA's Virginia Alvino Young speaking with Representative Mark Rossi. You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Ask a would-be entrepreneur, an owner of a startup. One concern could very well be the office space. Where is it? How much is it going to cost? What amenities will it have? Well, in Pittsburgh, as in other cities, the demand for co-working spaces seems to be growing. And here to talk about this trend are Anna Bixler, community manager for Industrious, which has co-working spaces in, I believe, 21 cities, including Pittsburgh. Welcome, Anna.
Thank you.
Also in studio is Robbie Halou, co-founder, chief operating officer of Beauty Shop, which operates 7 co-working spaces throughout the Pittsburgh region, plus 1 in Cleveland. Welcome, Robbie.
Thank you.
Anna, Industrious is national, came to Pittsburgh. Robbie, your home ground spreading outward. For each of you, why do you think the trend of co-working spaces is on the rise? We'll start with you, Anna.
Sure. I think I've noticed, I'm born and raised here in Pittsburgh, and I remember when I first found the job for Industrious, I had no idea what co-working even meant and the concept of it, really. I just knew I kind of wanted to be a part. And so I looked into it some more, got hired, and then we kind of came into Pittsburgh in May of 2017 is when we officially opened. But when I used to give tours to folks coming into the space, they weren't really sure what co-working really meant. They'd come up and they'd be like, okay, so I share these things. Mm-hmm. I share this cafe. I share this common space. And now when I give tours, fast forward, everybody's actually doing co-working shopping. So they're like, I have five appointments this week and at five different locations. And it's really cool to see. I love to kind of see the drastic change that it has made. And I think that it's going to be around for a while. And I can't speak to – I don't know exactly why. Or, Robbie, you might be able to speak to that. But
yeah. Well, in concept, why it's growing is because I think it solves a fundamental problem.
What problem is that?
I think it solves a problem of how a user of real estate is going to consume real estate. And I think over time what's happened is that there's been a really separation of value creation between the landlord and the user of real estate, wherein the landlord wants a long-term lease with the least amount of headache possible, and they want to sign and essentially walk away and hand over the keys to the tenant. And maybe there's a property manager in between that picks up the phone sometimes, and sometimes they don't, but they don't really care because they don't have, you know, any reputation to protect. They're going to just sort of manage the project and move on. And, you know, I think what co-working has done is, well, you know, it's done a couple things. First, I think it's provided a space for once disparate organizations and companies or solo entrepreneurs to actually come together. So there was this very early on, this sort of communal aspect. And I think you'll hear a lot about community and collaboration. And there's this sort of social aspect that co-working facilitates, right? And I often compare it to the role of coffee shops or maybe the role of it's certainly a social institution where people get together and discuss, and there's community and there's a lot of good there. So I think that's early on, that's what kind of sparked the interest. And I think moving forward, it's just made a lot of business sense because we come in now and facilitate an interaction between consumers of real estate and landlords and really deliver service to members, deliver hospitality, deliver you know, a better experience. And then also, certainly, there's benefits to landlords working with us.
Anna, you mentioned that people are now shopping.
Right.
So give us a sense, if you would, are the needs, the desires, the wants of shoppers of co-working in Pittsburgh, are they similar to or different than other sites, other industrious sites around the country? Do you know?
I would say that we are city specific. I mean, we are a national brand, but each location in our specific cities they have a specific niche. And for us, we're in one PPG on the 31st floor. It's very much those 8 to 6 companies. They're not all startups. They're professional businesses. The average age of a business that joins us is actually 13 years old. So it's a lot of remote teams. It's companies that are looking to kind of get out of the traditional office space and kind of go the co-working route. So I don't know if that actually answered your question.
Well, Robbie, I have to ask you because people are there. If they don't know Beauty Shop, they're scratching their head. Yeah. Hold it. What is this, a beauty salon, whatever? Yeah. You know. And you started in, I believe, 2010 in an abandoned building in East Liberty.
Yeah.
That was a beauty shop, lowercase b, beauty shop.
It had been a beauty shop. It was abandoned when we moved in, but it had been a beauty shop prior to us moving in, and they had this gold lettering signage on the window, and it was wonderful, and we just decided to keep it. And we've been trying to change the name over the years, thinking that it's not the right name, but feedback from our members and other marketing professionals is keep it.
It's interesting. You term members. They're not, well, in a sense, they're clients, but members. Why is that to both of you? Why do you look at them as members and not just renters or whatever?
Yeah, sure. Our members, I love going into work every day to kind of see what my members are up to. It's very much an industrious family, how we feel in the Pittsburgh office. We have done many events throughout the year. Like tonight, actually, we're doing a cycling class. 15 of my members are going, and we're going to go do a cycling class together.
Like Robbie's eyes just...
I wasn't invited.
It's not just making sure that they have an office space. It's about the experience, and it goes back to our mission statement, which is to make everybody proud and excited to come to work, and that's not just the work aspect. It's the hospitality. It's the events. It's the community that Robbie mentioned earlier.
Yeah, to both of you, if you think about it, I want you to envision a co-working space. Tell me, what do you see? What are the main attributes?
The main attributes are people. There tends to be some open space where people can hang out and collide and have conversations. So maybe a larger space than your traditional kind of proverbial water cooler corner. And there are private offices, and there are meeting spaces and communal spaces. And I think if you kind of go off that, there are spaces to meditate. There are places, spaces to where a mother could nurse or mm-hmm. you know, and there's a place to, you know, have a conversation. There's a place for a board meeting, and then there's a place to just kind of hang out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I think people are very surprised that it's not just a big open space. A lot of the times when people think co-working, they just think wide open workspace. Right. But we concentrate primarily on the private office. I know that Robbie has private offices as well, but it's a place where people can get their work done in their private office, but then come out for conversation and take meetings with the person down the hall, have some cross collaboration. So it's a little mix of both.
Is there a vibe that you're trying to create, even a sense of inclusiveness, even though these are different entities, different companies sharing a workspace?
Yes. I think for us, you know, inclusiveness is a multi-layered word. I would say, in contrast, and I'd like to say the industrious product, service, professionals, brand, fantastic, a really, really top-notch organization and product and service. But in contrast to them, say that where they tend to be on higher floors in downtowns, we like to go the other direction and be closer to the ground and have some sort of joint retail public space, right? So that public space for us, whether it be a cafe or some retail or just like an open event space, to us, I think signals to the community around us and to the neighbor, you know, hood, openness, inclusivity, come on in, right? That's the direction, you know, that's how we'd like to, you know, work towards inclusivity. Even then, often people don't feel inclusive. I think we can do a better job at signaling to every member of the community, you are welcome, but certainly something that we're thinking about.
Yeah. I can kind of speak to that, too. I would say everybody, the number one question I get on tours is, what type of member do you have in this space? Or who kind of occupies the space? And I always say it's such a wide variety, and there's really no rhyme or reason as to what type of companies are in the space. It's a lot of professional services, I would say. But I have startups. I have a company right now called RevTown USA, and they are making jeans.
Okay.
They're making jeans in the Pittsburgh market, and I mean they send them all over the country, but it's just really cool to see this startup company making jeans on the 31st floor of 1 PPG Place. Mm-hmm. On the other side, I have a lawyer who has his own practice, and he wants that address. And so from a lawyer to a startup to people in finance and design, we really accept them all. And it's really fun to kind of see everybody collaborate.
Well, that's interesting. You say they want that address. So how important is a prestigious address? Does it vary from person to person because it's 1 PPG?
Yeah, I mean, it is important. A lot of people, you know, sometimes it's businesses that are just getting started, and what better address to have than the 31st floor in an iconic building? And then to others, it just doesn't matter to them. They just kind of want a space. But I would say it is pretty crucial to folks that are just starting out. They're looking for that, you know, professional vibe and to kind of have that prestigious address. So it's helpful.
Robbie, if they're not looking for a big, gleaming downtown building, mm-hmm. what are they looking for?
Some practical things. You know, I think co-working is within the real estate industry. So, you know, location, 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 oftentimes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So close in East Liberty, for example, our Liberty Bank building project, a location, which was the location that we moved to right after our original spot was closed down. That is a hyper-local location. People, you know, stumble in from Highland Park, from within East Liberty. People tend to, on average, I think they travel 1.3 miles. It's really a community location, and that, you know, that each space is different. Like, it just, I think those are just two points in the continuum. Liberty Bank Building as a hyper local community neighborhood spot, and 1 PPG Place would be sort of the other side of it, and there's everything mm-hmm. in between. Mm-hmm.
you don't think of yourselves as landlords, do you?
That is.
All right.
Hardly. Well, okay.
So is the intention to be more than just a nice place to work, a space that's nice, where your work is part of your life? So what about amenities that sort of make the experience, you know, well-rounded?
Yeah, for sure. I always say, I use this on tours, but it's more than just the office desk and a chair. It's all about the experience. We try to make sure that every single person that comes through the door feels taken care of, and that's really my job. So I get folks into the space, but then I make sure that they stay really happy by making sure that we have yummy breakfast every morning and afternoon snack time. You wouldn't believe at 2 o'clock, everybody comes running out of their office to grab snacks. Weekly happy
like
hours.
Grad school.
Yeah. Weekly happy hours, or like we're going cycling, or we went to a pirate game this season. There was 30 members that came to us. It's these are my friends, and I think all of my members would say that they've met new people and they've developed new relationships from, you know, being in our space and coming out and taking advantage of those amenities. And you have different conversations than you normally would just working from home or a coffee shop.
Just have a couple minutes left. Robbie, how important are the amenities and the variety of amenities, the partnerships that you offer with other entities that your members can benefit from?
Yeah, I think they're going to be more and more important as we grow and as we evolve. I think Anna does a good job of executing on and describing kind of the early stages of this workplace hospitality world. I think it's going to continue to grow and it's going to continue to evolve, and we're all going to continue to learn and organically contribute to what that means. And it's going to mean a lot of things, not just community and events. It's going to mean other products, other services, and it's really going to be – the point is sort of elevating people's workday experience. And I think where that's going to go, I think that there's we've got many years to figure that out, and hopefully we'll both be around to kind of see that through.
Well, that implies many years to figure that out. That implies an optimism about – the trend that I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that has been on the rise. So you see that trend continuing?
Yeah. I mean, when we opened Industrious, that was our 13th location. And now we have 53 locations. And so that was just May of 2017. So Pittsburgh's been a great market. But overall, I think co-working is very in right now. And even Robbie has expanded as well. So I think, yeah, co-working is going to be here to stay for a bit.
Robbie, do you have expansion plans? I mean, you have, what, 7 locations right now?
Yes, 7. We certainly have expansion plans. We want to focus on quality. We want to focus on service. We're, we probably won't grow as quickly as Anna's company has in the past year, but eventually we'll get there until everything falls apart.
Okay. So
It won't.
Is there a certain aspect in our remaining minute, very briefly, is there a certain aspect to co-working that you sort of going to push the envelope on? You want to explore a little bit what else you can do for your members? Very briefly, Anna.
You know, that's a great question. I'm feeling the pressure. No, I just think that, I mean, we all have to get up and go to work each day. So why not make it so much better than just, you know, sitting at your desk and chair and not talking to anybody or having really delicious coffee and enjoying your experience? We all have to go to work every day.
Robbie, final word for you.
I think there's going to be a merger of co-working and retail. I think that the site of WeWork, the industry leader, moving into the Lord & Taylor department store in New York is a symbol of kind of things to come.
All right. Robbie Helou is co-founder and chief operating officer of Beauty Shop, which operates 7 co-working spaces throughout the Pittsburgh region and 1 in Cleveland. Anna Bixler is community manager for Industrious, which has co-working spaces in 21 cities, including Pittsburgh. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next show, the U.S. military has been mandated to beef up its ranks. More service members means more recruiting. And Major General Frank Muth says that's not as easy as it sounds, where data show half of America's youth can't even name the 4 branches of the military. He joins us tomorrow. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.